Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Alex Hurd. He's editorial director at Outside Magazine here in Santa Fe, and he's the author of the new book, The Eyes of Willie McGee, A Tragedy of Race, Sex, and Secrets in the Jim Crow South. And he will be speaking this coming Thursday, the 8th of July, at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So Willie McGee was an African-American man who was executed in 1951 in Mississippi for raping a white woman, Willette Hawkins, after some highly publicized trials. But until you wrote this book, there really wasn't a coherent account of the case. How did you come across this story and decide to pursue it?
Well, I heard about it in two different ways over a long period of time. I first heard of this case by way of an audio tape that was recorded on the night McGee was executed, which was May 8, 1951. And that tape was made right off a radio broadcast that went out from the scene. He was executed at the courthouse in Jones County, Mississippi. The person who had made the recording was a journalism teacher, advisor at Vanderbilt University, where I went to school. And he used to play the tape for students just kind of as a lesson in how much things had changed in the South since he had been in college. So he made that tape, held on to it, and played it for us just as a kind of an artifact. So I filed that away but didn't really do anything with it. And then a few years ago, I happened to be in a bookstore browsing and came across a book about the history of lynching and saw this case referred to in there in about a dozen-page treatment summarizing what had happened and making it clear that the case had been very famous at the time, which made me realize if it had been so famous, why haven't I really heard of it, or well, most of us don't know the details of this story. So that just inspired me to poke around, see what had been written, and I realized there hadn't been a full-length account of it.
Now, who was Willie McGee? Tell us a little bit about his life before the alleged crime.
Okay, McGee was a truck driver who delivered wholesale groceries to stores and things in Laurel, Mississippi, which was a small town in the south part of Mississippi where not really a cotton-producing part of the state so much as timber. It was, the whole area was bathed in pine trees. His father had moved to that town to be part of that industry right after World War I. So he grew up there, basically was a laborer his whole life, probably went to school only through sixth or seventh grade, and had not really, as far as I could tell, been in any particular trouble before until he was arrested and charged with this rape.
Now, this story precedes the book To Kill a Mockingbird, but there's some similar elements in the story, and one story that was told about the Willie McGee case was that the so-called rape wasn't a rape at all, but was rather a sexual affair that the woman, Willette Hawkins, had started. And that in itself is such a huge issue in the case. But what's interesting about it to me that came out in your book is that if that had been true, and we can talk about what is known about that, even if that were true, it was impossible to use a story like that, even if there were evidence, even if there were witnesses, in a courtroom at that time and place.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to remind people, in To Kill a Mockingbird, one of the main plot lines concerns the trial of Tom Robinson, who was very clearly falsely accused of sexually assaulting a young white female named Mayella Yule. And in the dramatic scene in court, Atticus Finch does a very convincing job of proving that Tom hadn't done anything and that Mayella had in fact tried to seduce him and had made up the story after she'd been spurned and her father discovered what was going on and had beat on her in retaliation for that. In the McGee case, it was quite different. The case, for one thing, it lasted 5 years. So it wasn't solved in a single dramatic day in court. There were three different trials. There were several years of appeals. And in none of the three trials did McGee's claim that there had been an affair not a rape. It never came up in court. He did tell his first lawyers and his first appeals lawyer that this was what had happened. He wrote it down in an autobiographical statement in which he described how this affair supposedly worked. They said in later interviews that they looked into it, but they couldn't find any evidence to support it. But they also make it clear that even if they had found evidence, they would have been terrified to bring it up in court. Several of them said, if we had brought that up, he would have been killed on the spot, and we might have been too. And they meant it. So those are the similarities and differences between the plot
right.
of the novel.
But so basically, in that time, it was impossible to say in a court of law a white woman instigated an affair, a sexual affair with a black man.
Well, I didn't research every case with these elements that happened in the South, but as far as I know, judging by this case and a famous case in Alabama in the 30s that involved the Scottsboro Boys, I don't think it would have happened the way it happened in To Kill a Mockingbird, in which Atticus very clearly turns the tables on the woman. So I don't know that it didn't happen somewhere else, but in this case, for sure, they kept that out of the trial because of fears.
I mean, there were people bringing loaded guns into courtrooms at that time.
Right. It was said at the second trial of Willie McGee, after the first one was reversed, that Willette Hawkins' husband, whose name was Troy, was basically caught by police bringing in a pistol. And obviously, he either intended to shoot McGee or to have that as an option in case he didn't like what he heard in court. Because I think there was an awareness on the prosecution side that McGee's story about the affair was out there. And so I think people were sort of primed for it to come up in court. It just never did.
This was an era of lynchings and just relentless violence against black people, and presumably every black man, including Willie McGee, was terrified of violence and of lynching and so on. What did McGee say? And I know that for a while he was apparently so terrified that he couldn't speak at all, but eventually he said what happened to him after he was arrested and what law enforcement did and said.
Yeah, at his first trial, which happened in late 1945, he didn't say a word. He was so scared, or he was pretending to be scared. That's what the prosecution said, but I don't believe it. He was so frightened that he didn't speak the whole day of his trial, and it was in two phases. There was a sanity hearing and then the trial itself, and the newspaper stories make it clear that he was terrified, literally shaking and making animal noises as he sat in his chair as the trial proceeded around him. So that trial came and went pretty fast. The jury was out only 2.5 minutes. He was found guilty, sentenced to death, and taken out of town, because during all these trials, he was kept in the capital city of Mississippi, Jackson, because they had a big fortress-like jail there that was safe from lynch mobs. By the time of his second trial, which happened in 1946, he still didn't testify at that one. And then there was a third trial in 1948, because it kept getting reversed because of all these procedural irregularities. He finally spoke at that trial. It wasn't really testimony. It was testimony related to whether his confession could be allowed, because McGee had written, and in writing and in speech, had confessed to the crime, describing how it happened. But what he said at the third trial was that he confessed only because it had been coerced. And according to him, from the moment he was arrested until they took him off to jail, he was beaten. He said that that alone wouldn't have been enough to make him confess, but that the sheriff, on the way back to Laurel from where they had arrested him, which was in a different town, literally said, "If you don't confess, we're going to hand you over to a mob in town, and you know what they're going to do." So his claim was that he only confessed because he faced lynching.
And he was also apparently, according to him, put in something called a hot box.
That's right. And the prosecution and people in state government denied that there was any such thing. What a hot box was, and they did exist. It was a cell that was placed near some source of heat, like near close enough to a furnace, that the cell, if left unattended, just became unbearably hot, like let's say 130 degrees. He said they put him in there for 2 weeks after his first arrest as part of their attempt to get him to confess in writing. I know those existed because I've talked to judges, old judges and lawmen down there, and one of them showed me where the hot box was in the Laurel Jail.
Meanwhile, law enforcement denied that any of that was true.
Right. I think his various claims were that there was an affair, that he'd been mistreated. They denied everything. And these claims were made primarily in state and federal appeals that stretched out from 1948 to 1951. Having read those appeals, especially the appeals to the Supreme Court, you see clear instances of the prosecution lying about what they'd done. One of the procedural things they were accused of, which turned out to be very important, in Willie McGee's third trial, which happened in 1948, the state and prosecutors were essentially under Supreme Court order to allow participation of blacks on the jury or the grand jury. And they put three Laurel African Americans who were fairly prominent in the black community on the grand jury, and the defense charged that they'd been planted there so that these were people who would go along and do what they were told and vote to indict him again and put him to trial again. The prosecution denied that repeatedly in appeals and in their responses to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it definitely happened. They did that because one of the prosecutors on the case, years after the case was over, told an interviewer that they'd done it. So you see, when you see something like that, that there was a conspiracy locally to rig how the system worked, it does make you wonder how far they would go in their goal, which was to get a verdict and send him to his death.
We're talking to Alex Hurd about his book, The Eyes of Willie McGee, A Tragedy of Race, Sex, and Secrets in the Jim Crow South. Over the course of his trials, McGee himself barely escaped lynching.
That's right. There was a fairly close call. What would happen, as I said, when someone was arrested in a case like this, usually by the 40s, they didn't keep them in the town where the arrest happened. They took them off to Jackson, and that was to protect them from the threat of a lynching. For McGee, the main danger of possibly being lynched happened when he went back either for a trial or, as later happened, for an execution date that was postponed. And the closest he actually came to being lynched was in the summer of 1949, when I think the third or so of his execution dates was postponed because the Mississippi Supreme Court granted a stay. That stay order came in at around 7 or 8 p.m. on the night he was supposed to be executed. They already had the electric chair set up, and people called from Jackson down to Laurel saying, the state Supreme Court has issued a stay order, and they said, well, we're not going to accept it unless it's literally brought here and put in our hands. So there was this high-speed car ride to get there. It's about 90 miles. And the sheriff took it by headlights, got the word to the executioner, and they shut it down. But in the newspaper coverage of that whole sequence of events, it's very clear that getting McGee from the courthouse to the car that would take him back out of town up to Jackson, there were people outside trying to get him. And they said they went out a side door to elude them. And it made it clear that if there had been one misstep or if he'd tripped, he probably would have been seized and taken away. It was a really close call.
You write in the book about a certain Senator Bilbo and That was an interesting illustration of how rhetoric on the part of elected officials can really encourage violence among ordinary people. Tell us about him.
Well, Senator Theodore Bilbo was probably the most famous of the racist Southern demagogue politicians of the post-war era. And he had been a two-time governor in Mississippi and a longtime senator who was a very supportive of the New Deal. He was a Democrat, of course, because all Southerners were basically Democrats back then. But he was a terrific racist, and especially after World War II, Bilbo's racist tendencies really blew up because black veterans coming back from the war and people who maybe didn't serve but were just tired of not having their voting rights. There was a renewed push for African-American voting rights in Mississippi, especially in the election of 1946. Bilbo was running for re-election that summer in the Democratic primary, and he just went off the farm in terms of his rhetoric. He had written a very racist book about the need to send blacks back to Africa, but specifically on voting, he, in speech after speech, he would basically say, if any black person, and he didn't use that word, tries to vote, the best way to deal with that is to see them the night before, and you know what that means. The comments were so outrageous that they touched off an attempt in the Senate to deny him his seat, which actually almost led to his ouster, but he ended up leaving the Senate because he was dying of cancer and never returned after 47.
And that kind of a role model, I mean, I don't think you say this explicitly in the book, but it certainly, if it didn't encourage, did absolutely nothing to discourage the practice of lynching.
Right. Now, of course, lynching was on very much on the wane by the end of World War II. It had steadily declined throughout the 20s and 30s. In 1945, there was only one officially reported lynching. There were several in 46, part of this wave of violence that happened after the war. There was a notorious lynching in Georgia of two African-American couples who hadn't really done... One of them had gotten into a fight with a white man. The other three hadn't done anything, and they were ambushed on their way home from jail and basically killed by firing squad. So there were several, there was a resurgence of lynching right after the war, but what was really going on more often was what were called legal lynchings, and that's what the McGee case would have been characterized as. And that means in a case where a black male was accused of rape or murder, he wouldn't be lynched, but he would get a trial that was so one-sided and hurried that many people felt that it might as well be a lynching because he didn't have a chance of escaping death.
It was even hard at that point to get anti-lynching bills through Congress, even when lynchings were on the wane.
Well, Congress never passed an anti-lynching bill in its entire history. The main impediment was the Senate. Sometimes the bills got out of the House, but the Senate was dominated enough by Southern legislators who in turn had leverage on whoever the president was that those bills always died, usually in filibuster. And one of the interesting things in the book is the attempt in the mid-30s to pass one of these bills. And it came pretty close, and that's when Franklin Roosevelt was president. His wife, Eleanor, was very much in support of anti-lynching legislation and personally lobbied him, along with the head of the NAACP, a man named Walter White. But he did not publicly back the bill, and it died in the Senate. And he made it clear in a letter to White that he couldn't afford, with the New Deal legislation he needed to get through, to alienate that Southern power base. So he backed off.
You know, you point out very clearly something that I think is an extremely important point, that there are two different issues in the South at that time. One of them is the innocence or guilt of whoever was being accused of a crime, and the other was the ability of the defendant to get a fair trial in the first place. Even if a person was guilty, his constitutional right to a fair trial was often not available.
Right. I mean, for all I know, there is a chance Willie McGee did commit this rape. I think there's a good chance of it. I don't really know what happened. The reason I don't know, and it's impossible to be sure, is because the trial was like a tennis match with only one person armed with a racket and the other person just sort of waving his arms. The defense was stymied in everything they tried to do. The judge and all the three Willie McGee trials was hostile to anything they wanted. Any of their motions were denied. They wanted to change the venue. He would say no. They wanted more time to bring in witnesses. He said no. Now, the additional problem facing defense lawyers back then was that the federal government wasn't really doing nearly as much as they would do in the 50s and 60s to defend the rights of African Americans. There was a real problem. These cases would go up the line, and the McGee case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court several times. They were reluctant to take them on. In the McGee case, the memos by the clerks who looked at the facts of this case and ultimately recommended that they not take it, it just boiled down to the simplest terms. They felt that they would have to retry the case, that they would just say to Mississippi, we look at this and we don't trust your courts to run a fair trial. They weren't prepared to do that, so they tended, if they did reverse any of these cases, it usually had to hinge on a specific violation of a constitutional principle that they could point to, like jury tampering or the refusal to grant a change of venue. With the McGee case, those things came up, but there wasn't enough in there to stick in the minds of the Supreme Court. So I feel that he didn't get much help from the federal government and the appeals courts.
How did his case come to the attention of the Civil Rights Congress and the young lawyer Bella Abzug?
Well, the Civil Rights Congress, for people who don't know, was a Communist Party-linked civil rights group. It was founded right after the war as basically a competitor sort of group to the NAACP. And in that 10-year period after the war, a lot of what counted for civil rights activity involved court cases. There wasn't a whole lot going on legislatively in Congress. So the name of the game often was defending these kind of cases, and they were all over the South. What happened was, because the Civil Rights Congress was communist-linked, the NAACP and otherwise liberal people in the Democratic Party didn't want to have anything to do with them. So they sort of operated in isolation. What they tended to do was try to identify cases that they could take on before the NAACP got to them. So they were competing for control of these cases. After McGee's first trial in 1945, there was Associated Press coverage, little stories here and there. It wasn't widely covered at first. And there was a tiny story in the Daily Worker, which was the Communist Party's organ. It was a national newspaper. And a man in New York who was part of the Civil Rights Congress saw it, clipped it out, and said, this is probably something we should look into. He sent a colleague over from Birmingham, an African-American far-left figure named Lewis Burnham. Burnham drove over from Alabama, did a lot of interviews, and filed a very good and accurate and objective report about what seemed to be going on in this case. It's one of the best things or summaries ever written about it. And from that moment on, they took it over. They arranged behind the scenes for his first appeal. And sometime in 1946, it's not clear, they approached Bella Abzug, who was at the time a young New York-based labor lawyer who was very far to the left herself, bordering on being a communist, but probably not. But she was very much in sympathy with their positions on things. So starting in 1946, she was in charge of the legal aspect of the case, but she never worked the case in a courtroom in Mississippi at the circuit court level. She arranged for local counsel, white males from Mississippi, to do the courtroom work, and then she did all the appeals.
And so tell us more about her and her role in this case.
Well, for people who are a little older, I think they all know who Bella Abzug was, but I find younger people don't know her as much anymore. By the 60s and 70s, she was a famous feminist and congresswoman. She started out her career as a lawyer, and she'd grown up in the Bronx, a Jewish family. Her maiden name was Bella Savitsky. She went to Hunter College and was a campus leader and often involved in campus politics, which at Hunter at that time were pretty substantial and involved international issues, and that's part of why you can tell she was so far to the left because of the positions she took. She went to Columbia University Law School, one of the very first women to go through there, and so she was a real pioneer. And in an oral history she did that's in the archives at Columbia University, she makes it clear it was tough. You know, there was a lot of chauvinism, but she excelled. She was on the Law Review, and she went right into the practice of labor law, working for a then-prominent firm called Witt and Kammer. So she was somebody who was known in New York activist circles as a left-wing labor lawyer, and she had a real ambition to... She wanted to do constitutional law, and one of the reasons I think she took this case was that she saw it was very likely to be the sort of case that would make it to the Supreme Court, so she could try to argue it there.
The people who defended Willie McGee, do you have the sense that they believed that he was innocent?
I think they did. I mean, when you look at the papers of the Civil Rights Congress, there's quite a few things in there, but there are a lot of unanswered questions. And one of the things that I'm curious to know whether they knew about is there was a little deception at the heart of Willie McGee's defense. There was a woman named Rosalie McGee emerged who said she was his wife and the mother of his four children. Rosalie became a famous public figure during the later years of the case. The Civil Rights Congress brought her north. She toured all over the North and West and Midwest speaking and asking people to help save him and telling what she said was the story of the affair and how she knew about it. But the problem was that she wasn't really who she said she was. Willie McGee's real wife was a different woman entirely who divorced him in 1946 and moved to Las Vegas. So Rosalie McGee was playing a role, and I find it hard to believe that the Civil Rights Congress wasn't aware of that. Why would they have allowed that to happen? I think it's because he had enough problems already. He was trapped in a system that was determined to kill him, and they needed to present the image of him as a very straightforward family man with a loving and devoted wife. So that's one of the things that makes me wonder, were they so sure he was innocent? Because when you look at those old cases, the Civil Rights Congress, much more than the NAACP, tended to cry right away that whoever the defendant was being framed. And I think they were kind of sloppy about that, or they were aggressive about that, because they felt the odds against their side were so great that it was fair to fight a little dirty sometimes.
How did this false wife emerge in the first place? Whose idea was that?
Well, all I was able to find out is she wrote them for the first time in 1949, because the letters written by her and McGee and McGee's mother are in the files of the Civil Rights Congress, which are kept at a library in New York. So she just announced out of the blue, "I am the wife of Willie McGee and the mother of his four children, and I need help." And one thing she needed was financial assistance because she was destitute. I think she actually had two kids of her own and that she did need subsistence money, but she let them know she was there, and before long they were writing her, giving her little checks, and they brought her up to New York for the first time in 1950. And right away she was going to dinners, making speeches, and I think they realized pretty quickly that whoever she was really just a country girl who had come in from a rural part of the state and moved to Jackson looking for work, that whoever she really was, she had a poise and an ability as an effective public speaker. So when I say that she may have been an imposter, I'm not trying to debunk her. I'm just trying to make it clear that she wasn't quite who she said she was. But in the sense that she filled this role, she was clearly devoted to him. However they met and whatever their relationship really was, she stuck with this case for years and worked very hard to serve as a spokesman and to help try and save his life.
Now, the late 1940s, you were seeing this, the CRC, the Communist Party, the Daily Worker newspaper and all this, and you were seeing a huge anti-communist movement in the rest of the country. And that put the McGee case in a really tricky place, because people who were inclined to support a black man who was possibly falsely accused of a crime didn't want to ally themselves with communists.
Right. So, again, the NAACP was against them. President Truman was asked to get involved on McGee's behalf, but he never came close to doing that because, you know, the Truman administration, people forget that the Cold War started before Joe McCarthy came along. The Truman administration was very vigorous in prosecuting and harassing American communists. One of the things that comes up in the book is a massive trial in 1948 and 49 of 12 top Communist Party leaders who were indicted under what was called the Smith Act. And the Smith Act basically said that if you were a member of a group that advocated the forceful overthrow of the U.S. government, that in itself was a crime. So that you could run afoul of the Smith Act without actually being engaged in a conspiracy or any kind of treason, just by being part of a group like the Nazi Party or the Communist Party that in theory would like to disrupt our system. So there was quite a bit of hard press against these left-wing people during the years of this case. Two of the leaders of the Civil Rights Congress, one named George Marshall and one named William Patterson, the whole time the Willie McGee case was going on, they were fighting off contempt of Congress charges that landed both of them in jail eventually. So they were battling in two directions at once, and the communist taint, such as it was, turned off a lot of people who would have normally been interested in a case like this. But one group of people that most people forget about, it wasn't just communists who supported Willie McGee. In 1948, there was a party called the Progressive Party, which was far left of center in the Democratic Party, kind of a breakaway from Truman. A lot of McGee's support came not from communists, but from people who had been members of the Progressive Party and had voted for a candidate named Henry Wallace, who was seen as a red, but wasn't really. He was just very much in favor of, calmer relations with the Soviet Union, and that turned a lot of people off at that time.
We're talking to Alex Hurd about his book, The Eyes of Willie McGee. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. And we're back with Alex Hurd, author of the book The Eyes of Willie McGee, A Tragedy of Race, Sex, and Secrets in the Jim Crow South. So how did the case finally play out? I mean, we know he was finally executed.
Right. The third guilty verdict came in the spring of 1948, and from then on it was nothing but appeals and quite a few dramatic episodes that were related to these appeals. One of the first protests related to a civil rights cause in Mississippi happened as an outgrowth of the Willie McGee case, and that was in July of 1950. He faced an execution date that month. The Civil Rights Congress sent a delegation of of progressives, and there were a few communists in the mix. And they had an audience with the governor of the state of Mississippi, Fielding Wright, and the state Supreme Court Chief Justice, who heard them out in a hearing inside the state Capitol building. This caused such a stir at the time that in the immediate aftermath of this hearing, in which they were pleading for clemency, which he didn't get, several of the delegates who had come down were beaten up, and one of them pretty severely. And that appears to have been something that was arranged with collusion of local police and Klan members. So it went on like that. What would happen, there would be an event and an appeal to the Supreme Court. They said no. There would be more procedure, a new execution date, and it was denied, but it kept rolling along. And in 1950 and 51, those were the years that it became a case that people all over the country and the world heard about. Slowly but surely, as the Civil Rights Congress fought in courts, they did a very good job of getting the word out and getting prominent people interested in this. Albert Einstein, Josephine Baker, Paul Robeson, all famous people of their time, were among the people who spoke out on behalf of McGee, saying they believed his story and that he should be spared. But ultimately, the Supreme Court's failure to step in any way, time finally ran out, and the execution happened in May 1951. The way it worked in Mississippi then, the state had a portable electric chair, and the chair would be set up inside the courtroom wherever the condemned man had been convicted. So in McGee's case, it was set up on the second floor of the Jones County Courthouse in Laurel. It happened on a Monday night, and there was a crowd of about 1,000 or 1,500 people outside the courthouse kind of watching and waiting for some signal that this had taken place. Most of that, there was also a fully stocked courtroom of observers, including relatives of the woman and newspaper men and just local officials. So it was very public, and it's hard to imagine today something like that happening, but that's the way they did it.
Doing this research, and the person reading, the reader of this book, really follows along every step of the way while you're trying to put this together. I mean, it's like trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle whose pieces were scattered from an airplane over five states 50 years ago. I mean, how did you start?
Well, I started just with whatever newspaper stories or clips I could find, but it was very skimpy. And as you say, this is a case for a long time I wasn't sure if I would be able to assemble enough information to tell a story and that I might just have to give up. A lot of times with these old cases down there, the basic records like arrest reports and transcripts are gone. And my first trip down there was in the spring of 2005. I just went down there to see what kind of information might be available. In the courthouse, I asked them for everything they had on the Willie McGee case, and they brought back a skinny little pamphlet with just a few pieces of paper in it. No transcripts. They said they didn't have it. In another town where one of the trials had occurred, a lot of their records had been damaged in a fire. So at first I was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to find enough. But slowly but surely, in some places down there and in some places as far away as San Francisco, bits of the record began to emerge, and I realized I probably could do it. The other thing I tried to do was find family members of all the major characters and actors in the story. And that was important because they knew about things that wouldn't necessarily show up in the record. The fact that Rosalie McGee wasn't his wife, I heard about during one of my first interviews, which was with Willie McGee's daughter and granddaughter who live in Las Vegas. And they said, yeah, this woman isn't related to us, and we've never been able to figure out who she was. So I had two things I was trying to do at once. Solve the kind of mysteries that were cropping up as I talked to people and found out that the story was more complicated than I had believed, and just get the fundamental